Welcome to Opening Dharma Access, a podcast where we hear stories from BIPOC teachers about their Dharma experiences and practice, and how those inform the ways they are sharing the Dharma today. I am Lama Karma Yeshe Chidren, your co-host for this episode. Joining me today is co-host Kyra Jewel Lingo. Hello, Kyra Jewel. Mm-hmm.
I'm
great. How are you doing?
Good, good. Can you hear well?
I can't wait to hear your story. Yes, I can hear you very well. I thought we'd start with your just sharing with us your identities racially, ethnically, and any other specific identities within that arena of Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
Sure. So I identify as Black and mixed bicultural, so Black mother, white father. I was born in Chicago. My mom from Chicago, my dad from the South, from Texas. In terms of class, while my mom was working class and my dad middle, upper middle class, my parents had chosen to live in a family religious order that valued simple living and relying on donations to do the work of development and human development projects and living in community. So we had a very against the stream kind of upbringing where we weren't in mainstream cultural norms, whether it was what success means or what financial well-being means. It was really about being part of this community and that larger vision. It was kind of a monastic structure for lay families with children. So it was a very odd way to, it's hard for me to exactly place myself in class because it was voluntary simplicity. And my dad was choosing that, but my mom didn't have much of a choice outside of that community in terms of the people she came from. And I'm cisgendered, female. And born in the U.S. with English as my first language. But grew up very internationally and lived outside of the U.S. almost as much as I did inside the U.S. So because I have a lighter skin privilege, I've been able to blend into many places. So that ambiguity of skin color where people would think you're from India if you're in India, or think you're from Brazil if you're in Brazil, or think you're from Egypt if you're in Egypt, that kind of thing. So when I was a nun in a Vietnamese community of Plum Village, mostly Vietnamese community, very international also, people couldn't necessarily tell what I was and sometimes assumed I was Vietnamese. And I'd get comments like, oh, you speak such good English. When I was in my robes. So those are some of the parts of my social location.
Great. Thank you. So what do you found in practice settings that were supportive or not, and from your practice in life as a BIPOC, how does that inform how you teach now? More broadly, and perhaps to students of color.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think when I think of first coming into practice spaces, it was Plum Village. It was this monastery in southwest France. And what was supportive at that time was you know, feeling like I could really belong there. Not necessarily because there was many Black people there. There weren't. I was the first Black monastic in my community. But it was a majority people of color community, with most of the monastics coming from Vietnam and some from other parts of Asia. And then maybe about a third were Westerners, mostly white Westerners. But most of the lay people who came were white, from Europe, from the US, from Australia, New Zealand. More people started to come in later years from Asia, and Latin America, few from Africa, Canada. But that was, you know, when I started going on tour with Thay as a nun in my first years as a novice. We'd do several, you know, maybe 5 or 6 retreats throughout the United States on a 6-week or 2-month tour, and there would be thousands of people at each retreat, and they would be very, very white. And that was a real disconnect for me. And that's when a number of us, me included, were like, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this picture. And so that's when we were really looking around at how could we create more retreats, you know, more spaces where people of color were really welcomed. And so 2004, we started our first people of color retreats that Thich Nhat Hanh taught. Is the first one, and you know, 400 people showed up for that retreat. It's one of, I think, one of the largest gatherings like that still. You know, another piece that I found, it's interesting, like, I was a Westerner who wasn't white in the community, which wasn't that common. And so I had the experience of feeling grateful to be in a mostly BIPOC community. But more than anything, I think I identified as a Westerner in a largely Asian community. And language was a huge place of, you know, sorting out belonging. And so a lot of things happened in Vietnamese in the community. And I learned, you know, kind of very modest Vietnamese, very simple conversations, but most of what was happening in the community, we needed translation for in the meetings, or, you know, the talks would always be translated. But anyway, and so there was a lot of also just noticing that cultural difference was really one in which, you know, I noticed I really needed support as a Westerner, you know, and that there were things that weren't some of what you were talking about, Lian, about this not explaining, and then how you can't actually arrive sometimes in your body if you don't know why this is being said to you, or why, you know, this is being done in a particular way. So there was that too. Within the BIPOC umbrella, there was, well, you know, do you belong in this culture? Are you from a different culture? And how that would impact how you experience, you know, how I experienced the practice, or being, you know, sometimes it got conflated, you know, like that to practice well meant to be more Vietnamese, like, you know, to be more culturally Vietnamese. And so that was sometimes problematic, where we as Westerners had to sparse out, well, wait, there's practice, but there's also like this overlay that sometimes people didn't see that they would be projecting onto people who were different than them. And so we would be told we weren't practicing well. So that was something I would chafe at sometimes. And then, you know, as I transitioned out of monastic life, I think, you know, I started to practice in the insight lineage as well. And I found, it also very white, although that there were efforts to, you know, I did the 3-month retreat a few times at IMS, and as I came out of my monastic identity into the lay community of the Plum Village tradition, I also found that to be very, very white. And as a Dharma teacher, because I became a Dharma teacher as a nun, and then as I entered the lay Dharma teacher community, it was really white, older, middle class, upper middle class, and white. And so I really was like, wow, I really don't see myself reflected here in this group. But what I appreciated in the insight world at IMS was I did 2 retreats, fall retreats, and then the third one I came back. So I did 4 years in a row, this longer retreat. The third one, I think, was almost a third BIPOC. They did a real effort to diversify and to make it accessible. And that was a very special experience to be around more Black people, more Latina folks, Asian folks, and to, you know, what I noticed, even though it was totally silent, the whole retreat, we weren't talking to each other except like the last few days, there was warmth in that retreat. People, we weren't looking at each other because that was, you know, the Theravadan practice. You don't look, but people were holding doors for each other. They were helping take each other's plates to wash. Like there was this, a lot more, just the sweetness of showing, we see you, we're here for you, we love you, you know, and I just noticed that. It was a really interesting thing to have been at 2 retreats that were mostly white and then this one retreat that was at least a third BIPOC, and how that shifted the energy. And the questions in the hall were much more related to, you know, the issues that I was, you know, also facing as someone who was BIPOC. So, and then having teachers who also spoke about BIPOC issues. So one of the things I'm noticing as I talk about this moving into insight tradition too, as I compare it to my life in the Plum Village tradition, is that was a monastic-centered experience and the insight was a lay-centered experience. So that's another layer of difference. And now as a lay person, you know, that's my orientation. And so the emphasis in the insight tradition on BIPOC retreats, regular BIPOC retreats, training BIPOC teachers, which I was one of the folks trained in the Spirit Rock teacher training, which was majority BIPOC teachers. And Insight Meditation Society also did a training that was focused on training BIPOC teachers. So that has really felt so empowering for me, that the institution was able to see there's really a lack and we're going to do something about it. We're going to create, you know, sanghas that speak to the BIPOC experience, retreats, more teachers, making sure there's a policy at Spirit Rock, at least, that on every teaching team, it can't just be all white. It can't be, you know, all white men or all white people, that there always have to be teachers of color. So when I think about my life as BIPOC informs how I teach now, You know, I think a lot of my teaching, and this is part of my being trained by Thay, being trained in a Vietnamese community. But it's also when I was a nun too, I loved bringing in interactive, fun, spontaneous kinds of activities. So I was teaching games, mindful games, and circle dances, and getting people to interact and use their bodies. I had a dance background from before I became a nun. And I see that's what I'm bringing in to my teaching also now, is like what this relational mindfulness. So how can we do a metta meditation where we actually talk to each other and then contemplate and talk to each other and, different kinds of breaking down the ideas of what practice looks like and how it, so much of it is this like individual thing where we're, have our eyes closed and sitting on a cushion, but what would it mean to, be in dialogue, be in a group, be moving, be singing, exploring spontaneity and play. So I learned interplay. I'm an interplay leader. It's a body-based practice, unlocking the wisdom of the body through voice, through storytelling, through movement. And so I often integrate that into my teaching. And I think that comes from being BIPOC and that kind of awareness of there's so much more happening than just at the level of the mind or verbal, and using music and song in how I teach. So I'll sometimes end a guided meditation with a song, with a practice song. Sometimes that kind of thing just goes in deeper than spoken words. Talked a lot, so I'll pause.
I would love to know how you talked a little about it already, but how do you find that you have brought into your teaching your experiences? So how do you work with students of color now, mm-hmm. Based on your own experiences?
Yeah. I find it really important to name, that white supremacy really exists and how it operates. And I've been sharing a lot in different communities that I'm a part of that if we're not learning and studying about race and white supremacy and the history of race in our culture, that we're not doing real Dharma practice. I really don't think that we can stay ignorant about how those things operate and be really truly practicing the Dharma at this point. There's just too much is riding on everyone waking up around this because it impacts us so, so deeply. And so that's a general framework for anyone that I'm teaching. I feel like just naming it, talking about it, making it be part of, if I'm talking about climate change in a talk, I talk about how it's connected very much with white supremacy and how, patriarchy. And so just to keep the spotlight on how this functions and within our Dharma spaces as well. So I think that really supports BIPOC students just to have that be named, that's not something that gets invisibilized or normalized, that we don't talk about that or that's not an issue. So I was teaching a group of people and someone, a brown woman, mentioned her, in a question, something about how, she doubted herself because she felt she needed to be super prepared and come across in this really rational way, and I just said, look, that's part of that is that we all exist within this white supremacist culture that values certain kinds of thinking, you know, over other ways of being, other ways of knowing. And so I wasn't like telling her, here's how you can fit better into this system that by its nature devalues you. I was trying to, you know, help her see part of her where she was stuck was also something systemic and not just something in her that needed to be fixed or something, you know, she wasn't good enough at. So I think affirming folks, and not, it's not about, you know, encouraging a victim mind state, but it's really about seeing what part of how this oppression functions is to lead us to believe we're at fault, that we are defective as BIPOC, as women, as low income, as immigrants, whatever. And so recognizing that that's how it functions is part of liberating ourselves from that story. And claiming our own agency, our own capacity, because there's so much that we have in us as BIPOC practitioners that we don't get credit for. We're not given credit for in our society, but it's really there, and we can really nurture that, those strong, you know, ancestral wisdoms. So one of the things I do working with folks of color, and I do this with others too, but especially in BIPOC spaces, is to hold space for ancestors. So we'll often begin with, like at our BIPOC retreats, when I was a nun and on my retreats now, we start with creating an ancestor's altar. Everyone's invited to bring something that honors their ancestors. Put that on the altar. And we've done it virtually on Zoom as well, where you know, you can showcase your item or bring a picture. And we created a slideshow. Everyone's item got displayed with music. And we go into pairs and we talk with the partner about that object. So a lot of bringing in and honoring the ancestors, naming ancestors. You mentioned prostrations, Leon, something that we created as part of our BIPOC retreats in the Plum Village tradition. It's a big part of our practice is prostrations. We had the five touchings of the earth is what we called to spiritual ancestors, blood ancestors, land ancestors, and to our loved ones, and then to someone who had made us suffer. Those were the five. But we expanded that third category of the land ancestors to include a prostration to each different ethnic or racial group. So we touched the earth to our indigenous ancestors, and that was a whole paragraph. So you'd be prostrated on the floor, on the ground, having someone read to you what were the things that we're so grateful to our indigenous ancestors for, what was the suffering they endured, how do we want to continue them? And then you stand up, and then there's another one to African-American ancestors, and then Latino, Latina ancestors, Asian American ancestors. We also added Middle Eastern ancestors and white, you know, European ancestors. So we would touch the earth to each group and really take time to honor naming names. Like who are the people we want to really lift up their specific histories who have been, you know, important land ancestors. So that's a way. And then I think the last thing is just really emphasizing self-love and caring for ourselves, honoring our own experience, like really, really making very emphatic bringing emphatic attention to our Buddha nature, because that can really be buried down there even more deeply in BIPOC students. So really emphasizing this radiance that's a natural part of who each of us is, that's in our ancestors, that's in our histories, and our resilience of all that we've come through. And that we can love our skin, whatever our skin looks like, our features, our hair, our lips, our noses, our body types, like really inviting that as a practice of contemplation to really enjoy and love our bodies.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking that so much of, as a BIPOC teacher, that it's about restoration. It's about reminding us our wholeness, and the connection is, you know, as the Dalai Lama said, we all want to be happy, and how it's our just as much our right to be happy and with ourselves and our place in the world. Yeah, it's interesting to hear, because I was at the first People of Color retreat at Spirit Rock, and then the 10-year anniversary, and so it's great. Mm-hmm. Now I meet teachers or teachers in training who always had BIPOC retreats to go to and BIPOC teachers, and it's a huge, huge difference. So it's really great to hear that you're part of that and shaping that.
Mm-hmm. We were inspired by those Spirit Rock retreats, because those are, I think, the first ones. So we said, we got to do that too.
You know, it's, over 20 mm-hmm. years. So, almost 25 now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything else, Yeshe?
Thank you, Leanne. No, I think that's wonderful. I just love hearing your story, Karajola. There's just such a beautiful confluence of so many different threads. It's just a delight.
Thank you.
This has been Lama Karma Yeshe Chidren and Reverend Leanne Shutt for Opening Dharma Access with Karajola Lingo, sharing their Dharma experience as a BIPOC teacher. Join us in coming months for discussions with more teachers. Look for new episodes on the first of every month. In between episodes, we'll also share a meditation, mindfulness practice, chant, or other form of practice from our guests with you. Come back to check that out and to keep on listening to our BIPOC teachers. Be sure to subscribe for notifications and to rate and review the podcast to help us spread the word. Check the episode notes for resources and email us at suddenleap.a2z@gmail.com with any questions. Let's open Dharma Access to all beings. Mm-hmm.